Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. And today we have special guest Joe Brunsman back. You guys may remember him from before. And he's from the Bruns Group. Check out his website. It is thebrunsgroup.com. He also has a pretty special YouTube channel that, and that's a big thing for me to say. There's not very many people that I actually follow their work. And I do patiently await for the next YouTube bell to chime that says that he has a new video coming out, which was what, Wednesday this week? You had a new one. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. So,
yes. I watched it about like 10 minutes after it published.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. I forgot to put it on the MSP subreddit because a whole bunch of craziness popped up. But okay. Yeah, it's all about the new Lloyd's of London exclusions. And man, is that a, at least for me, because I'm a nerd, when it comes to insurance, what an interesting topic that's going to have really big impacts on businesses if there is some type of cyber war. And
well, and I think my big takeaway from it was just a confirmation of the attitude and viewpoint that I've had about insurance for a very long time. At least I'll say cyber insurance. I probably have a very similar opinion about other types of insurance as well, but most certainly in the cyber insurance aspect. I personally would rather put my money into real, measurable return on security investment risk mitigation approaches that are literally, you know, moving the needle on the progression of the closing the gap between where you are and where you want to be, compared to something that says, I'm going to buy this insurance policy and then I'm going to hope that it provides me coverage, and then get into a hot debate with basically a carrier about whether or not you're going to get paid and how much you're going to get paid and what's covered and what's not covered. Now, for the record, I do think people should have insurance. I'm never going to be the person to tell people how much insurance they should have.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that they are always best off to approach life as saying, okay, I'm going to have insurance, but I'm going to do my best to never need to use it.
Oh, I'm right there with you. So, kind of my viewpoint of insurance is, it is a tool, not a toolbox, right? It is part of the solution. It is not the entire solution. And I think the biggest issue that I see from like my side of the table is you have a bunch of insurance people selling this stuff, and client asks a simple question. Hey, do I have coverage for ransomware events? Right? Very easy question. And what would the insurance guy say? Oh, yeah, it's right here on the front page. It
depends.
Yeah, and you're right. The real answer is, it depends, right? Let me tell you about the OFAC exclusion, where, hey, you may not have it in this exact scenario. Ergo, 3-2-1 backup strategy, immutable backups, etc., is a really good idea. Now, the problem with the insurance industry, and one of the many problems I will say, having worked in this industry for 10 years, is the general rule, you saw it in the video, is that the insurance guy is not viewed as a risk advisor, typically in a legal system, right? So the insurance guy has no general legal obligation to read, understand, or advise on what he's selling. So you have
you even provided the statutory reference to the fact.
Yeah, it's from Understanding Insurance Law 6th edition. And it's, I mean, I could cite all the court cases as well, but it's like, hey, you have people buying this that don't know what it is. They don't know the limitations. They don't know the capabilities. Being advised by people. Yeah.
Who don't understand it.
Who may have never read it. Who don't understand, right, the capabilities and limitations and all the kind of the legal aspect involved that could go around this. And so you kind of have the blind leading the blind. And that's one of the reasons I try to put out so much free material, is to say like, hey, do you need cyber insurance? Yes. Are there limitations to this? Yes. And it's becoming more and more limited. Ergo, my first, I kind of say this tongue in cheek to people, but I tell them, all right, a successful year is when I call you once and I take your money. Because right, if we're talking twice, you're having a really bad day and it's about to get worse. So what's the easy solution to that? Work with your IT folks. Right? Map to a framework, increase your security, plan of implementation, right? They know your network better than I ever will. So, hey, do everything you reasonably can to try and avoid talking to me twice in a year.
Yep.
And it's shocking to me how uncommon that is in my industry, right? Because it's the equivalent of saying, yeah, you have car insurance, but you don't want to get into a giant car accident, right? Like, drive safe. It's the functional equivalent of,
right?
Yeah, you don't want to speed everywhere. You don't want to blow through stop signs. Like, you don't want to go...
You know, in the home insurance space, you know, you're still going to replace your roof before it's completely bombed out. You don't expect the insurance company to rebuild your house because you didn't maintain the roof.
Yes, precisely. Right. There's moral hazards in all of this. And
right.
Kind of the corollary to that in the cyber insurance world is it's becoming more and more common where we're seeing these cyber insurance policies, and it's always buried at the bottom in an exclusion that maybe the insurance guy doesn't understand. You know, he doesn't know what a critical vulnerability is, why it's important, why patching a system is not the same as updating Windows when you leave for the night.
Well, let me tag off of that moment because, or that particular item, because that is, I think, that's probably, I think, the biggest gap that everybody seems to have in where they're at and where they need to be. And it's that to this day, and I work with very large organizations all the way down to very, very small organizations. To this day, I have yet to actually see anybody actually have a vulnerability management policy that's in writing, that the executive management team supports and understands, and that they've communicated the necessity of it throughout the entire organization, right? So In order for a company to have an effective outcome, they have to first have a policy. The policy has to have executive management support. And then there has to be a consistent effort across the organization to say, yep, that's part of our strategic objective. We're going to have vulnerability management. So, you know, what does that turn into? Well, that means we can't have shadow IT. We have to do third-party information security risk management. It's a lot cheaper and easier for us to just not buy garbage than to try and clean it up after the fact. You know, we have to do soft SDLC. We have to do software bill of materials analysis, right? There's a whole piece of things there in that. And I think that it's a challenge for a lot of IT service providers and certainly internal IT departments to actually have that kind of leadership, which is where I think a CISO or a really strong CTO can be a pivotal differentiator for an organization. But I've seen so many insurance policies that will have that table in there that will say, okay, you have this much coverage, but then if we determine as part of their investigation that you experienced this issue because of an unpatched vulnerability, and then there's a whole sliding scale as to how long that vulnerability has gone unpatched. And so you could very quickly take a $10 million policy and turn it into $1 million in coverage. And I've seen $1 million policies go down to $50,000 in coverage. Now, When I've talked to attorneys about that, their interpretation on it is that if then an organization has that in their policy and they don't manage to that effect, then they have customer contracts who are dependent upon that cyber policy being in effect. They've now committed a breach of contract with their customers because through their conduct, they really just don't have the coverage that they've said they were supposed to have. So this is, I just bring this up because That's exemplar for probably virtually everything in a cyber policy, that it needs to be understood by management. Management needs to be advised effectively by their trusted advisor, let's say their CISO or their CTO. And then a policy and strategy throughout the organization needs to be executed to make it so that that investment that the organization has made into that insurance policy and then all the contracts that they've signed that are dependent upon it, that that's actually fruitful.
Yeah, I mean, easy example. You're a CPA firm. You're an accounting firm. Tax season comes around. Historically, it's been very common for CPA firms to go, all right, during tax season, when we are at our when we are at our busiest moment. I was an engineering major, not an English major.
Well, you know, most busiest is probably a fairly accurate representation of what their lives are at that time of year.
Yes. And it's, you know, it's very common where they say during tax season, nothing gets changed. You don't play with the network. There's no updates, nothing. Now, that's good, great, and grand until you have a vulnerability that needs to be patched. And so, yeah, it, to use a military term, it behooves management and the IT folks to both have that conversation. Ideally, the insurance guy's part of that to say, all right, business owners, this is about managing risk. So here's the risk if you don't do that, right? If you decide you're an adult, you're a business owner, make your own choice, you can make the conscious decision to say, we are not going to patch our systems. We are willing to take that risk, right? That's one thing. But to just completely not know that that risk exists right. to begin with.
Right. Well, so
it's just negligent.
Your point's excellent. And there, I'll just bring up a real world example that I've seen where legacy debt, right? Legacy technical debt, everybody sees it all the time, right? And sometimes you end up in a situation where you have a server that has this legacy technical debt and it has all kinds of unpatched things on it, but you literally can't patch it. Because if you do, the risk of patching it and therefore bricking it and making it unavailable is a higher risk than the risk of actually like just not patching it. You know? So that's again one of those things where it really has to be this team approach. It needs to be executive management really needs to make the time to understand that risk and to partner with those technical advisors to be able to say, well, we could do A or B or C or, you know, whatever the other options are, but then get behind a decision and support it. And a lot of the failure that I see is where there's this, you know, I'm going to abdicate this to you, right? I'm going to delegate these IT problems to you and IT, and now no more involvement. And then, I mean, how many times do you see projects or initiatives that just don't have the support throughout the organization and then they fail as a result of that?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. Right?
Everywhere.
So it's, I think it's unfortunately, it's, you know, business owners, it's like, okay, we rely on our CPA for tax advice. We rely on our attorney for legal advice, right? And why do we do that? Because that's not what we do. Right? I mean, well, I have a law degree, but even then, there's like special areas of the law. It's just not what I do.
Right.
So, ergo, rely on the subject matter experts. That doesn't mean that you just talk to your attorney once a year and you say, okay, well, we're done here. Or it's all in your court. You got it. It's like, no, it's a constant discussion.
Sorry, this thing that's hilarious. Who has ever actually said to their attorney, it's all in your court, you got
it? Right? It's laughably bad, and none of us would do that. And so that's
there's no attorney that would accept that. They'd be like, wait, which crack pipe did you just grab and smoke from?
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, for us to assume as business owners that, oh, the IT folks got it, right? Or the insurance guys got it. It's like, no. No, like insurance policies are legal contracts. Both parties in a legal contract have duties, obligations, requirements, etc. And so to think that, hey, you could just buy a cyber policy and you're good for the year, to me is so silly and so short-sighted. And that's why I don't get a lot of sleep. And that's why I work 6-7 days a week. It's because, you know, and often it's errors that are so easily solvable led to a cyber claim that I love hearing about these like super technical whiz bang breaches and, you know, all these crazy things, but it's like, that's man bites dog. It's very often, I'll say 95% of the time, it's the IT guy was living in his shed because management doesn't want to talk to him, because what's our job as business owners, right? To some degree, it's like we're supposed to know everything about every facet of our business. But then they don't want to learn the IT side because they're like, well, I don't want to look dumb by saying, what is EDR? Like, why do we need this? Right? It's like they don't want their ego to get kicked down a notch when realistically it's, hey, man, the smartest guy in the room is going to go, there's a whole bunch of stuff I don't know. So talk to me like a five-year-old. Tell me what EDR is. Right? Let's talk through this, explain the business case. I'll give you my opinion. You give your opinion. We'll have a conversation and then we'll make a decision from there.
know, I've even experienced some cases where a business owner will just have what I think is inappropriate negative self-talk. And here's what I mean. Like, talk to a business owner and they'll say, oh, I'm never going to understand that. Like, really? Do you tell your CPA that? You know, do you tell your attorney that? Like, or is this just an IT thing? Because I really feel like that's just negative self-talk. I mean, if they can run a business and they can understand legal risk and accounting risk and financial risk and, you know, real estate risk and investment risk, right? They can understand all the rest of these risks. You know, maybe I'm optimistic here, but I think that they can also understand information security risk. And they should, and, you know, of course, a lot of these things are also physical risk. So I've yet to meet a business owner who can't understand physical security risk. You know, they all have homes with alarm systems and stuff. So they can understand physical security risk. They can understand information security risk as well. So I think sometimes it's just like a, it's like head trash, you know, it's this negative self-talk. So I want to pivot to, you know, you've shared with me in the past that, you know, the insurance industry is it's very mature. I mean, like really mature, right? Been around super, super duper long time, like the way back, and is a very heavily regulated industry. And that there's a level of assurances that come from that. And so as a result, you know, we both have the same opinion in that, and we've articulated this already, that we see the value in insurance, but one should always conduct themselves in a manner that says, I'm never going to need to use insurance because I've been a prudent, you know, operator, right? Yeah. What we've seen, though, is we've seen kind of some products pop up in the market where people are purporting to provide warranties, and they don't use the term insurance, they use the term warranty. And I've actually even, and I want to go to that product in a moment here, but we've also seen maybe in the last 2 to 3 years, other companies popping up that like are trying to specialize in only cyber insurance. And they've come to the IT service provider industry and they'll say, okay, IT service provider, you go ahead and you become basically certified with us and we're going to evaluate your technology stack. And then we'll use that to extend that forward to your customers. And now there's a whole slew of issues with that because I can't think of a circumstance that I've ever seen or been aware of where any IT service provider can say 100% across the board that every single one of their customers completely is fully up to date with every piece of like technology and security and configuration and everything else, because these are all, you know, unique businesses. So I feel like that model doesn't work at all. And I bring that up because my understanding is that the warranty claim has exactly the same set of requirements that like, yeah, this warranty is only valid under the circumstances that, you know, all of your configurations are exactly as we thought it was. So I think there's just a whole lot of problems with these things that are claimed as warranties. So, you know, I wanted you to teach us about that.
Yeah. So I'll say, you know, kind of from the outset, really like the first mention of insurance, if my memory serves me correctly, is, oh man, it goes back to like, it's like 1700 BC with Hammurabi's law/code, right? Where they're talking about like sea captains and like, you know, recovering of, you know, things lost at sea, et cetera, et cetera. It's like literally a form of insurance. So it's like, this thing has been around a long time. And with any like very mature industry, obviously sometimes it's like, all right, it feels like it moves too slow, but there's reasons for that where, you know, it's market pressures, it's laws. So like, when you're just talking about insurance, you have McCarran-Ferguson Act, you have state insurance laws and regulations, you have National Association of Insurance Commissioners and all the model laws and regulations that they promulgate, you have the Federal Insurance Office, you have on and on and on, right? All these various state laws, et cetera. They govern all this stuff. Why? Because anytime you have an industry this big, there's going to be tomfoolery. And so there's laws that are built to provide protection for the end consumer, because the people buying these policies, to a certain degree, it's like they don't have a team of lawyers to negotiate all these contract terms and look over it, right? Much less would they know the inner workings of financial stability of these insurance companies. And
well, it's the same reason the SEC exists.
Yes, right? So, I'm not a big fan of government, but it's like, all right, we can't let these big guys take advantage of the little guys, right? So there has to be some checks and balances involved with that. Now, when you start working in, so I'll say, obviously, it's really hard to start an insurance company. It takes a lot of money. There's a ton of regulations. You got to file all types of, various reports and et cetera, with the, even down to the state level, right? There's 50 different state insurance commissioners. They all have their own particular requirements based upon historical losses, and you got to validate stuff and provide numbers, and you can only provide so much insurance based upon how much reserve you have to pay out. So that way you don't just, essentially go bankrupt and go belly under. And if you're getting close to that level, there's all types of like conservatorships and things that go on. Anyways, moral of the story is it's a very mature system. It's hard to get into for a reason. They don't want just any Tom, Dick, or Harry to start an insurance company and start issuing policies with whatever they want on there, because it's going to be bad for everybody. So that was kind of my first take was, all right, why would you, if you're like, making this better mousetrap, why would you completely circumvent all of those protections and make it a warranty as opposed to a cyber policy? Because when you get to warranties, there's not a lot of really like rules and regulations that dictate what you can or cannot put in a warranty when it comes to, if you have products, I believe that's the Magnuson-Moss Act. Like if you're selling hair dryers and it comes with a warranty, right? There's rules and regulations on what that can be. But if you're just selling a warranty on a professional service, I don't know, outside of maybe some aspect of the Uniform Commercial Code, which is super vanilla, I don't really know what consumer protections
or are involved. Only other thing I could think of would be like FTC criminal fraud statutes.
Yeah, it's like if you're just blatantly committing fraud. But by that point, it's, hey man, a whole bunch of people are out a whole bunch of money. And, maybe a couple of people go to prison, but the end client still gets screwed.
Right. They're never going to be made whole.
Yeah. And, the marketing around these warranties is just so laughably bad that it just flies in the face, even if you know nothing about insurance, right? It just flies in the face of common sense, right? So there's one warranty provider out there who's saying roughly a third of cyber claims get denied. And I'm like, okay, well, I've been doing this for 10 years. Anecdotally, based upon the thousands of cyber policies I've placed, that's not true at all. But also, even if it were true that I just happen to live in this golden castle where everything goes correctly, because I'm magically so good at my job, if nearly a third of this one policy type had claims being denied, no insurance guy would sell it because we'd be getting sued into oblivion. And the state insurance commissioners would be crucifying insurance companies for doing that. And everybody would know somebody who had a cyber claim get denied.
Yeah,
it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, the anecdotal data that I have also, and my anecdotal data comes from talking to breach attorneys and insurance brokers, large insurance brokers as well. And they tell me all pretty much the same thing, which is that cyber insurance pays out except in the instances of absolutely egregious lies. Like, oh, we said we had MFA, but we didn't. And
yeah,
right. And then even then it was still a partial, right? It wasn't like, oh, we're just going to completely deny everything. So there's always some sort of payout that seems to happen. And so for many years, right, the insurance companies were just taking it in the pants, and they have become more stringent in their requirements. And so their loss ratios have gone down. But yeah, to your point, I mean, definitely not. I mean, I have no evidence, anecdotal or otherwise. I mean, I would think it would be all over the front of New York Times or Wall Street Journal, like, oh, don't buy cyber insurance because it doesn't pay, you know, like, but we don't see any articles like that.
Yeah, it's just, as far as I'm aware, it's just blatantly untrue. Like, there's just no, in no world can I imagine where it's a fact that a third of cyber claims get denied. If nothing else, it's the cyber insurance industry is annoyed because their policies are just way too broad. They're covering things they never even anticipated or wanted to cover. Why? Because it takes a long time for insurance policies to get standardized, right? Because that particular risk has to arise. Ergo, we have to find a solution for it. But to do that solution, we have to go through all the various state insurance commissioners, et cetera, get that language, right, in accordance with their own state rules and regulations, validated that we can even put it on a policy. And that can take years. Like, cyber war is a great example. Back 10 years ago, when I first started hopping into this product, I was reading about this very academic exercise of cyber war exclusions, right? And if the hostile war-like exclusion would apply to a cyber war and how insurance companies could deal with this. Well, 2017, you had NotPetya, right? That came around. And just recently, at the end of 2023, right? So roughly 6 years later, they finally got together and put out these model exclusions that Lloyd's syndicates are supposed to put out, right? So it took 6 years on $3 billion+ of concentrated losses, right? It took 6 years for them to go from this to, okay, these are the exclusions that we're going to start adding to these Lloyd's syndicate policies. It's like, it takes time.
Well, I think part of that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think that part of those exclusions are also because they have to be able to get past the regulators. I mean, I can't imagine a situation where the regulators would just allow such a terms and conditions alteration that would result in the effective nullification of any viable coverage.
Exactly, right? The regulators, I'm sure there was years of back and forth between Lloyd's of London and regulators to go, okay, that's a bridge too far, pull it back, right? Or we need more clarification here. And even then, the exclusions, there's going to be some litigation that arises because those terms, it's a term of art, not a term of science, ergo, it's going to be circumstantially dictated, right? And that took 6 years.
Yeah, and one of the things that you brought up in your video from earlier this week was attribution.
Yeah, that's going to be, that's interesting.
That's one of those nuances that is existing on a case-by-case basis. And that simple attribution component has that's the delineating factor in some of these cases.
Yeah, right. And it's, how do you begin to deal with, you know, these, let's say, ransom groups that are in these, you know, faraway nation states, like, how do you begin to prove that those are supported or directed by that nation state, right? Well, the nefarious actor.
And I don't know. And I, at a business level, like, spending time on something like that is clearly not a good use of one's time. What people should do is they should be coming to a conclusion that says, okay, because that risk does exist, that we could have an uncovered claim because of that factor. We don't have control over that. Let's just make sure we don't get ransomware, right? Or let's at least make sure that in the context that it does happen, we're not going to really be that concerned about it because we have a solid, tested, vetted incident response plan, IR playbooks, many, many, many backups. You know, we've got our retention policies in effect. I think there's so many things that one can do proactively to mitigate these risks. I was just having a conversation yesterday with another MSP that I was doing some CISO consulting for. And I told him, I says, you know, the paradigm that you ought to be using with your customers is that everybody should just get in their mind, I need to spend some amount of money every month on making my situation better. Because this whole situation, I mean, it's an elephant, right? How do you eat the elephant? One little bite at a time. And when people say to me, well, how much is this going to cost? I'm like, well, what is this? You know, let's first define this. Now, are we going to spend 6 months creating a definition of what this is? You know, like, or can we just pick a budgetary number, come up with that number and say, okay, at a budgetary level, we're going to apply this amount of effort towards making this situation less risky on a consistent basis, right? That approach works really well.
Yeah, exactly, right? And it's the same thing I really tell to all my cyber insurance clients. It's, we got this thing, there's limitations. You need to start working with your IT folks to go, all right, how do we mitigate this particular situation, right? It's no different than any other business evolution fundamentally, right? It's, okay, nothing comes without risk. How do we mitigate that risk, right? What are the elements of risk mitigation? Only one part of that is insurance, right? It's a very specific part of it. It's one part of it. And so...
And it's an edge case.
Ideally, yeah.
Yeah, you have to look at it as an edge case because it's not practical to go in and invoke insurance every little time something happens. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Or if you want to do that, call me because your insurance premium is going to be astronomically high, right? It doesn't make sense to do that. So it's,
right.
You know, it's like, hey, do you drive your car? Yeah. Well, you have car insurance, but you also wear a seatbelt for obvious reasons. Like,
yeah,
do you have
oil
health?
Changes. You don't drive on bald tires. You change your brake pad.
Yeah. Do you have health insurance? It's like, yeah, you have health insurance. Doesn't mean you eat yourself into a diabetic coma. Like, obviously, the health insurance is going to come, you know, it's going to pay for your bills, but you've already lost the game. You know,
right.
You've already lost.
Yeah.
So it's like, anything you can reasonably do to increase your security posture, to me, I'm like, hey, do that because you don't want to call me twice.
Yeah. I just want to inject that, you know, I've done 2 webinars now on getting return on security investment. And both of those webinars are basically articulating there is a mountain of things that you can do that are basically free. It's just work. It's like basically one-time work that you need to do. And I've got it correlated in terms of these are the risks and then these are the mitigations. And it's in a pivot table. And so based upon that pivot table, it's like, you know, if you do these mitigations, you're going to have the biggest bang for your return on security investment. And I make this argument in the webinar saying, like, if you don't have the top 6 completely nailed down, why are you spending your energy and effort elsewhere? I mean, unless you have a regulatory requirement to do so, or if you have like a cyber insurance requirement to do so, fine. I understand that those are other requirements. But in the context of how do we just simply prioritize effort, it's actually pretty straightforward to figure that out. It's not, you know, this is not voodoo magic, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's people, it's always, you know, it's appealing, I think, in an intellectual level, right, to charge towards complexity. But we often do that at the expense of the problem staring us right in the face that is easy to solve that would have the most impact.
Well, there's another factor to that. And I speak to this, you know, me with my CISO hat on, I'd say probably over 90% of problems are people in process.
Oh, 100%. Very, very rarely do I see, of like the hundreds of cyber claims I've dealt with, I very rarely see some super high-end hacker group getting in. Very rarely do I see some really complex method of intrusion and all this type of stuff. It's like, hey, it generally comes down to somebody clicked on something they weren't supposed to. They screwed up. They weren't doing security awareness training. They didn't have email filtering. Like, we can talk about the controls, but it's a person screwed up. Now you're out a bunch of money.
So it's people in process. And so the reason why these things don't get the attention that they deserve is because organizations need to have strong leadership in the term of, you know, in the form of generally a CISO or a CTO that are going to be able to craft a vision, articulate the vision, and then create an execution plan towards. how do we correct these people process and policy, lack of policy issues, right? And that's why I think those things don't get a lot of attention, is because, oh, they're not the easy button.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's, people are hard.
Yeah, it's, getting people to do things differently, that's not easy. So I want to pivot to another thing that you saliently identified as something that was a component of these warranty offerings, where they were claiming to be better than insurance. And that was to pay faster. So what has been your experience with the warranties that you've investigated versus insurance, for example?
Yeah. So I mean, once again, I've dealt with hundreds of cyber claims. And I will preface this by saying, it's not like I have no love particularly for insurance companies. I've probably hate insurance companies more than anybody who listens to this, because I'm the one that has to deal with them all the time, right? Like way exponentially more than probably any business owner will ever deal with an insurance company. It's my all day, every day. So it's not like I'm out there defending the cyber insurance world, right? Like, I think it has problems. There's things that I'd want to fix. But that being said, I've never had an issue where a client goes, I'm not getting paid fast enough. Like, it's just never popped up, right? And why is that? It's because, well, pragmatically, most of the stuff that happens with a cyber policy, the insured, the person who bought the policy, doesn't actually pay for, right? So it's, you pay your deductible retention. That's the most you got. That's your skin in the game. Everything else is coming from the cyber insurer, right? Absent some wacky reimbursement type policy, which...
Well, right. And they tend to make those payments directly to their preferred providers.
Yeah, they have panel counsel. They have panel vendors, and they have established rates and established contracts and established SOPs. And that's what they do. Like, it's a well-oiled machine. So to say that, like, somehow businesses are out this huge amount of money for a long period of time, I mean, it's well established in the case law that insurers have a duty to pay for what they said they were going to pay for. And
I think the caveat, though, is covered items.
Yes.
But I think that also would still apply in the warranty space, right? So it's not as if the warranty is going to cover more things than cyber insurance would have.
No, if anything, the warranties I've seen so far cover markedly less at lower levels than a cyber policy would cover to begin with.
Well, and then you mentioned the weasel clauses that were in the warranty terms and conditions.
Yeah, I mean, like, some of those were, let me see, one of them dealt with, let me look this up. You got me on the spot here.
Well, here's the one you sent me. Was, in the event that the warranty company approves a claim request, they shall make the payment to the customer within 30 days of such approval, provided that the warranty company reserves the right to postpone the making of such payment by up to 90 additional days in the event that more than one of the parties to whom the warranty company has issued a limited warranty experience related event. And then they reserve that right subject to the customer's prior written consent, which of course the customer would have had to have provided their prior written consent, because otherwise they would have never gotten a warranty, right?
Yeah. So it seems quite silly to me that it also makes me question the underlying financials of some of these warranty companies, where they're going, all right, we have a month to pay you, but then if it sounds like, by the strict language of the warranty, if even one other person also has like a related security event of some type,
right,
which
they
don't
go up
define,
to like, what, 120 days at that point.
Yeah, it's up to 120 days, which makes me think, well, I've never seen that on a cyber policy. That's wackadoo. And that makes me question. I'm like, well, how much money is in the pot there for these warranties? Because we don't know. I haven't seen it released anywhere. And I think it's probably for a good reason. And then on top of that, it's, well, cyber policies don't do that. You may have in a cyber policy something called a widespread event, but that's vetted by insurance commissioners and it's actually defined. And that would have to be like an event so large that you could bankrupt an insurance company, like a multi-billion-dollar insurance company could get bankrupted. So I'm like, all right, I don't like that clause, but I understand the reason. But to say, hey, we're only offering maybe $100,000 or whatever under this warranty, but if another person also triggers the warranty in a related way, I'm like, dude, surely you got more than $200,000 sitting in, like, surely, right? But we don't know. So that makes me think that there's a big problem there.
Right.
It's you circumvented all the safeguards and now you got a way out over here. And then there was another clause in there that said, hey, the warranty company can just change the warranty of their right. own accord.
Right, right. Without at its sole discretion, unilaterally modify terms of the customer warranty.
Which to me, I go, all right. I actually asked my wife the other night. I said, hey, would you ever buy an insurance policy if the insurance policy said, like, hey, we can just change whatever this thing is during the policy period and you won't know until you look at our website? She's like, that's insane. Why would I buy that? And I'm like, precisely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would like to presume that we have these angelic personalities that are in charge of these warranty companies that would never do something like that. But
nope.
having worked in this space, I go, all right, money does weird things to people. And I am not going to, like, I don't just trust insurance companies. It's what is written on the page that we could put in front of a court if you act crazy as an insurance company.
When you bring up another fascinating point, there is put in front of a judge, right? So it needs to be either really, really established, vetted language that is very clearly defined what that means, or it needs to just be outright plain language.
Yes. Yes. Like I want one of these warranties. It's like, oh, we're going to arbitration. And I'm like, no, I don't want arbitration in something that's not governed by well-established case law. I want something that's going to go in front of a judge and a jury that's going to go, the big guy screwed the little guy and the big guy's got to pay. And here's all the common law and all the case law where this has been done 1,000 times before, right? Like, I want the insurance company to be utterly terrified to screw over my client, right? I don't want unilateral changes with, it didn't say anything about notice either. It's just,
no, hey, no, there was no notice.
Yeah, it could just be on our website. So it's like, it just strikes me as such a terrible idea. And then for MSPs to start encouraging their clients to buy this stuff, to me, is comically bad. Like, it just sounds so dangerous from a liability perspective.
Well, let me pivot onto that one, because I that's the thing that has just completely, I mean, it just, this whole thing set off all of my, you know, red flag alarm bells from the very beginning. And it's like, it's so difficult to get a client to do all of the technical controls and all of the policies and the people and the processes and all of those other things to do it correctly, right? It's so hard to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I said earlier that I've just never seen any IT service provider who had all of their customers, you know, exactly the same, performing at exactly the same level, doing everything correct, right? I mean, it's bullpucky, right? In fact, I don't even think I've ever seen a company that just only had internal IT, right? Let's just take the IT service provider out of it entirely, that could say, oh yeah, you know, I mean, all of our technical controls are correct and you know, all of our people processes and so forth are correct and all of that, you know. So then if you have this warranty that says that the payout of the warranty is contingent upon all of these things being in place and being correct, that right there just sends up the horse hockey alarm bells of like, that's just, let's just be real. We're dealing with humans here. It's never going to happen. And then when the MSP goes and injects themselves into that, and they're the ones that sat with their client and recommended that they buy this less than upstanding product, then the customer is going to be having a perception that, well, you are responsible for the configurations for this and you recommended it to me. Well, now you're going to die.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes.
As far as I'm concerned, this is a lose-lose, quadruple lose every which way you slice it. It's a lose for the client and it's a lose for the IT service provider.
Yeah. I mean, if we just flip the script and we go, hey, how qualified is your insurance guy to sell, I don't know, sock services to your clients? You'd be like, what? How qualified is your insurance guy to sell firewalls? I mean, I could. I got a degree in robotics. I'm in IT. I 100% don't do that because that's not what I do all day, every day, right? Like, yes, I have maybe some foundational knowledge, but it pales in comparison to what people like yourself, you do this all day, every day, year in, year out, that it's like, hey, MSPs, it's like you don't even know what you don't know about this thing, right? And the dangerous, as I view it, is so high in comparison to you could take that time and energy and improve your business. Your business could make more money, right? Work on your sales and marketing, work on your internal policies, have more conversations with clients about security. They're like, I just don't understand the appeal of encouraging a client to engage in what they would perceive as, I will say, a financial product from their technical guy that doesn't necessarily understand the ins and outs and underlying, I guess, lack of probably legal framework on what governs a lot of this stuff. That it's like, why would you do that? Right. And point blank, like, you want the insurance guy to be the bad guy. You want the insurance guy to come in and say, hey, in 2 weeks, you have to have EDR. And then the MSP, you come in as the hero and you go, ah, damn insurance company, that sucks. All right, let's figure out how to solve this problem. Right? Now you're the good guy. But when some cockamamie warranty scheme goes sideways, or they're not going to pay out your client for the better part of a year or half a year at least, right? They're going to be looking at you, the MSP, going, why did you tell me to buy this? Right? And then what legal recourse do they have? I don't know. And then you got to start thinking, all right, well, what liability has now been transferred back to the MSP, where the whole goal of getting cyber insurance for your clients is you're transferring risk away. So the goal of this is risk transference, not risk aggregation. Right? That's the whole goal. It's the whole goal.
Oh, that was very salient.
Right. And then you got to start thinking, you're like, okay, well, let's say these companies, they're now aggregating all their risk. So one MSP has a really bad day, bad guy goes to their RMM, hits all their clients with ransomware. And let's even presume that the warranty is administered by angels and they pay out for all those issues, right? Well, now instead of, you know, 5, maybe 10 different cyber insurers all dealing with their own little risks here or there, right, with ransomware, add all that up. And now you got to start thinking, all right, is there a waiver of subrogation against my MSP? I haven't seen it in these warranties. So why can't that warranty company now sue you and your tech E&O policy to recoup all those losses, when it's like, you just entirely defeated the purpose of what I've been screaming from the rooftops for, what, 3 years, right? When I put out a video on the MSP subreddit, one part of which was why you should have your clients buy cyber insurance. Like, it's just, it doesn't make sense. It seems super risky. It seems like you're increasing your odds of a claim against your MSP. And now you're just aggregating risk all over again. And you're injecting yourself into the potential bad guy territory.
My position has always been, if you're not an expert in it, or you don't have enough control or visibility into it, then you can't understand the risk or assess the risk, and you certainly can't manage it or control it. And so therefore, you're left with an option which says disengage, right? Disengage. So in the event of looking at some warranty thing. I can't control the terms and conditions of it. I can't predict well enough what could or couldn't happen. I don't actually even see a need for it. I think it's a solution in search of a problem that doesn't exist. And to your point, it's just, I see literally no upside, because there's not a single time in all of these years that a client has ever come to me and said, oh, would you provide us insurance? It's just ridiculous. And it, you know, it's no different than like, oh, gee, you know, can we buy a warranty for our switch from you provided by you, right? Because that's not the same thing. Who provides the warranty for the switch? It's the hardware manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back to that whole risk transfer, which is, you know, one of those areas where I think, like, if somebody's looking at like a hardware as a service contract, they've got to be very clear about who actually, you know, like, where exactly does the hardware warranty come from? So
yeah, to add one more wrinkle to this, right? Some of these policies have coverage options for incident response. Now,
why? That's supposed to already be in the cyber policy.
Well, I'll even add another wrinkle to that. I, despite my best efforts, I've had a few clients over the years who were, they didn't want to call me, right? Until they were absolutely sure they had this cyber issue, right? So they just went out on their own, had a full-blown forensics analysis, right? Now, with that, they paid good money for that forensics. In which case, then they finally call me, and my first, you know, unfortunate news to them was, well, now you're going to go through that again because your insurer does not have a contract with these people. They've not vetted these people. They will not accept, right, these third-party findings because
right.
It's not in your contract, aka your insurance policy. Now we're going to start butting up against all the breach notification laws if that's going to be an issue, dealing with timelines, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So I'm like, unfortunately, you just wasted a ton of money, right, to have the gumption to call me to tell you that we're about to spend even more money and just go back through that exercise all over again. So it just doesn't strike me as a good idea in any way, shape, or form. I guess, I mean, I could think of maybe very niche scenarios that are kind of so outlandish that I would even question the need of having some warranty there to begin with, right? Which leads me back to the fact of that's probably why they're offering a warranty, is they know that the odds of using it are like so small that it's just kind of psychobabble.
Well, that's why it's intellectually dishonest, in my opinion, because it, like I said, I think it's a solution in search of a problem that doesn't exist.
I mean, and you know, I will say that I work with a ton of MSPs. And so, honestly, I write way more insurance for MSPs than I write cyber insurance on a standalone basis. So it's not like I'm out here defending the cyber industry. It's not like I think, oh my God, this is going to take over the world. I'm going to lose my house or something. Like, no, I don't think it's that. But what does annoy me is what you said, which is, I think it's intellectually dishonest. I don't see the use case for it. I don't see them citing their references for these statistics that they appear to be pulling out of thin air. And I'm already kind of on edge anytime that there's some new whiz-bang pseudo-financial product for MSPs anyways, because I'm like, I have never seen an industry more abused by their vendors than the MSP space. So it's like you have all these private equity bros that are like, oh, it's grown. We got to get our piece of the pie. And I'm like, how about you just find a way to legitimately help MSPs that are providing a good service that need help, right? As opposed to trying to do all these workarounds to find an angle to make your money so you can exit and then it's the next guy's problem. It's like, no, just help the people that need help that are doing the good work, trying to get these SMBs to be secure. Right.
Well, I mean, I can tell you why it's not just that industry, but I think a lot of industries function that way, is because parasitism is highly popular.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and like, I have a rule in my insurance brokerage. Anybody that comes in the door, I don't care if I'm licensed in their state or not, right? I will help that person, right? I will sit on an hour-long call with that person and I will say, all right, let's say it's an MSP in Alaska, right? I'm not licensed in Alaska. I'm not going to get licensed in Alaska. There's not enough business there for it to make sense financially for me. I will still sit down with that MSP for an hour and I will say, all right, let's talk through your MSP, right? Here's some videos that I've made that hopefully will solve some of those particular pain points that you have. Now, let me point you towards someone I know that's licensed in your state. Like, this is the type of policy I think you should need. Talk to them about X, Y, and Z. Here are the places you need to look to make sure it covers what you're looking for. Ready, go. And it's like, why? It's because I think those people need help and there's nowhere else for them to go, right? And it's, I remember day one being an insurance guy going, I don't know anything about anything. Like, what am I doing? The licensing process did not prepare me for this. And it's like, yeah, man, if we don't help these people, it's like, guess what? My kids drink tap water and I have a vested interest in the tap water not being poisoned. And who's the guy, right? Who's the team? Who's the MSP in my local municipality, right? That's taking over the security there. Like, yeah, I don't want those guys going out of business, right? It's like, hey, the more people you help, the more money you make. But to try and like do a bunch of end arounds and like, you know, fish your way in to make a whole bunch of money at the expense of MSPs, like, I don't like it. And so it's like, I'm kind of at the age now where I'm like, you know what? I'm going to say what I think is true. I'm going to help people out. And I'm going to leave it at that, right? I mean, if somebody could prove me wrong, prove me wrong. But I haven't seen it.
This is the same reason why I do Breakfast Bites and why I have ever since 2004 is because I don't think that more regulations are the solution. I think people being informed decision makers is the solution, because that puts that contextual knowledge in their hands and their mind, and they can use their own, you know, eyes and ears and their own critical thinking process to look at it and say, okay, here's my context. Here's some context that's been described. You know, are there similarities? How does that apply to me? How can I incorporate that into my thought process? And they can basically correct issues on the demand side. A great example of that is I did a couple shows on how a business owner or an individual could vet a tax preparer to assess whether they were FTC safeguards compliant and IRS compliant or not, right? So the solution isn't more FTC regulations or more IRS regulations. The solutions is for people to be good decision makers in who they do business with and what they ask for. And I think it also bolsters the whole concept of, you know, you talked earlier about how everything is it's a shared responsibility model. Right? It's, you know, you can't just like, you know, chuck something at the attorney and say, oh, it's your problem now.
Yeah, the world doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't. It certainly doesn't work that way in IT, and it certainly doesn't work that way with tax returns. So this has been great. Do you have any final thoughts for us on this topic?
You know, I'd probably just say, I mean, I hate to be as crass. I want to say like stay in your lane, but what I'm trying to get at there is don't go headlong into something that you don't understand, right? I always tell my clients, I go probably way too in depth on their policies. And I go, okay, here are the rules. You can bend the rules. You can break the rules. You can play by the rules, but don't play the game if you don't know the rules, right? So like, I don't gamble because I don't know the rules and I'm not going to do it. So if you don't have a knowledge advantage, don't play that game, because odds are you're going to lose.
Yep.
And so whenever something new pops up, I mean, if we just have a technology corollary here, it's like, hey, somebody comes out and they say, hey, there's this new super secret whiz bang technology that we have that's going to solve this problem, right? As a tech person, what do? We go, before I sell that to somebody, I'm going to be really skeptical and I'm going to be looking at every facet and corner of this. So I think that same skepticism needs to apply to really insurance products, warranty products, doubly so, right? To say, all right, let me start with skepticism. Let me figure out the rules of the game. And if it's just so imperceivable that it's this otherworldly thing that's so like magical, right? How many times as tech folks have we seen like the next big thing and then it just flops, like Google Glass?
Well, I mean, there's this whole concept of minimum viable product in the entire software industry. And what the end result of that is that we see is 5, 6, sometimes 20 years, that software's still a bag of poo.
Yeah.
It's just a bag of poo. That's all it is.
Yeah. You know, I'd say.
It never really became a good product, you know, but they didn't stop them from selling it. And if people would have done some appropriate due diligence on it, they probably wouldn't have come to that conclusion. That's why I think a lot of this is intellectual laziness as well. I mean, I see fairly consistently people are asking others and saying, oh, this product or that product. And I'm like, that's not for me. What works for me doesn't necessarily work for you. Your context is different. You're going to have a different set of requirements. Certain things are going to be a higher priority requirement to you versus me. So the process has got to be, you have to define your requirements. Part of that in the case here of like cyber insurance is, what are my risks? What am I trying to mitigate? And what are my options? And doing that investigation to try and figure out, I could do this, I could do this, I could do a hybrid approach, but this now requires effort, right? It's the same sort of effort as sitting down with a requirements list and dev testing a couple software packages.
Yeah, like on my end, people ask me almost daily, hey, what's the best cyber policy? And I'm like, it depends. Like there is no best. It's, I got to know a whole lot about your business, how you operate inside of your business, what your exposures are outside of your business, what your just internal fears are within your business, right? And then we can get close, right? I'll get as close as I reasonably can. But, you know, part of it's how much are you willing to pay? How much risk are you willing to accept? You know, but like it just takes time and effort and, you know, a lot of mental firepower to get to that point.
Well, the amusing part about the, you know, increasing premiums that I've seen is, of course, you know, the higher the premium, the higher, you know, you want all this coverage. So you're going to pay a higher premium. But the requirements list to get that coverage starts going through the moon. And through that whole entire process of saying, all right, well, now we're increasing our technical controls, we're increasing our policies, we're increasing all of these, you know, protections, and we're doing all of this, you know, work that drives operational maturity. And via that method, you're reducing operational risk.
Mm-hmm.
Do you now need the extra fancy pants, you know, insurance policy?
Yeah. I mean, you know, like I have one guy called me and he was like, I want $10 million worth of cyber insurance coverage. And I was like, hold up. Like, who are you? What's your business? Like, what do you, you know?
Right. Could you ever have a claim that would arise to $10 million would be the next question.
Yeah. And that guy, you know, I start asking him a bunch of questions about his network and what's his security like. And I was like, hey, man, to be fair here, like, you probably don't need $10 million. Like, I can't tell you not to get it. But what I can say is, maybe if you spend a little more on security, you wouldn't need this much insurance. And he goes, I have to have this to sleep at night. And I'm like, I'm trying to go through and say, like, all right, you know, it's not like 10 million makes you twice as safe as having 5 million.
No, it doesn't.
Right. And he just goes, I have to have this to sleep at night. He goes, tell me the cost and I'll pay it. And I'm like, you are literally funding my child's Star Wars Lego habit. Like, I can't in good conscience tell you that you need this much insurance. Like, in what world does an insurance guy say, like, buy less insurance? I'm like, but I'm telling you, I think you're wasting your money here. There's other places this could go.
It's actually probably really a waste, because the higher that coverage, the higher the sets of requirements to achieve the coverage to even have a policy that will pay. I mean, you have to meet these requirements.
Yeah.
And so, you know, maybe it was some sort of a perverted effort to force him to have, like, you know, the appropriate technical controls he probably needed to begin with.
Well, eventually I just told him, I was like, listen, man, I can't in good conscience sell you this policy. I'm like, I don't believe in it. I don't think this is a good idea. I appreciate you reaching out. I'm like, I can't sleep at night if you're buying something for me that I just don't think you need. I'm like, I think that's out. I was like, if anything, having that much insurance might actually increase your risk because of your business size and the industry that you're in. I'm like, I was like, I'm sorry. I appreciate it. I'm not your guy.
Yeah.
You know, and man, I wish there was just a little more morality in the financial services world where, you know, it's not a zero sum game. It's
right.
The more people you help, the more money you'll make. Just find a way to help people. Don't find a way to pull the wool over their eyes and do a bunch of end arounds so you don't have to deal with a bunch of rules and regulations. And, you know, you don't have to put a bunch of weird stuff in a warranty form that makes no sense to me. Like, just be a good person, help the world. Like, I'm sure,
just brought up something that I'm always thinking of, which is, okay, what's my counterparty risk of simply information disclosure? So, you know, let's say you go and you do business with this, you know, one of these warranty companies. What now is the risk of your information disclosure when they're compromised or just bad data handling practices? It could even just be, you know, a minor disclosure. And I think that that's something that most people don't realize is that there's disclosures that happen all the time, every day, continuously, in a ubiquitous manner. And almost none of them actually get classified as a breach, and almost none of them are actually known. And as a result, 100%. Right? And so as a result of that, data is getting leaked constantly. And the, you know, one of the reasons why I have never liked the concept of going to, there are some kind of specialty kind of intermediary brokers that only focus in cyber insurance, you know, whereas like, I know that you're an advocate for the necessity of like tech E&O and cyber being in partnership with each other. And you explain that very well in a number of your videos. In the essence of going to just the specialty cyber provider, they're literally taking all of this information that you provide and they're shopping it out all over the place. So they're just like spreading it around. And when I've asked the question, where the hell does all this data go?
Yeah. You know,
I can't get an answer from them. So how am I supposed to do, you know, counterparty risk management when they themselves can't even tell me what they're going to do with the data, who has access to it? Like if you just, you know, chuck it over the fence, they transmit it to their parties and then what happens with it? And I'll wrap up my little rant here on it in saying that I have done some investigations on some local generalized insurance brokers, you know, like casualty insurance and stuff, you know, business class, generalized local casualty insurance brokers. And I have found they have no role-based access control at all. None. Zippo. So let's say they have like 200 brokers or agents. Okay, I'll use the term agent. Let's say they have 200 agents. They have no segmentation inside their system whatsoever to say that this is the little team of the three agents that work together that support these accounts, and only these three agents are able to see these accounts.
No,
they have it where, you know,
everybody,
every single agent in the entire insurance company has 100% access to all of that information, right? So if we know that even on the inside of one agency, data handling practices are not secure, what incentive do I have to take that and shove it out to more parties?
Yeah, I mean, and think about it this way, like the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, right? They've adopted a model law that's going to get pushed out to all the states. And some states are already starting to regulate insurance companies proper just because of the type and amount of information they have. A lot of that came from, I believe it was the CNA breach, where like everybody's applications got stolen, et cetera. You know who doesn't have those regulations? Warranty companies. Right? I mean, like,
yeah.
It's, yeah, and it's, you know, there's a lot of snake oil salesmen in the insurance world. So anytime I see a brokerage, like, I specialize in what I call the professional lines. E&O for a very select type of company or companies, tech E&O, cyber insurance, some D&O, that's it. Now, why do I do that? Because anytime you see somebody that goes, we just sell cyber insurance, my first thought is, well, you're probably broke, because the average SMB, like, you know, small business cyber policy is $1,700, maybe $2,000, right? Your brokerage makes, we'll say 10% of that. And the guy selling it might make like 5%. So you got to be selling a ton of cyber insurance, which is not that easy because you have all these other agents that have worked with those companies for years. So I'm like, that makes me think you might be playing a little fast and loose. Obviously, you have no data security. Like, I really question what you're doing. Like, I've had people from some of the largest insurance brokerages in the world reach out to me and they go, dude, love your videos. We used it for training today inside of our brokerage. And I'm like, if you're like a $1 billion brokerage, I mean, you know, thank you. I feel, you know, special. But like, if you're using my videos to train your staff that's selling these $1 million+ cyber insurance policies, you're wrong, because there's stuff I don't put in the videos because it's too technical and I would just lose people, right? Like, I can't make a 7-hour video on this one specific clause.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a different audience. You're doing it for the public, whereas they should be having internal training that's tailored to a different audience that goes to a different level.
Ideally. And that's where I go back to, hey, people buying this stuff, like, these are legal contracts. You both have obligations. You might want to start figuring out what your obligations are. And, you know, and it's also like, I have people constantly ask me, hey, I was on a phone call today, actually this morning. And he goes, hey, do you have a list of what cyber insurance companies want from a company? And kind of the totality of this conversation was, you're missing the point, right? It's not, hey, what do these insurance companies want? It's, how do we get as much security as we reasonably can given our financial limitations? And then we go to the cyber insurance world, because defense comes before response, right?
Right.
Basic kind of 101 risk management. Right. Yeah. So it's
in all fairness, I think it takes a long time to rectify issues. You know, just because of, if a client came to me and said, I have $300,000 and I want you to spend it in a month, it's just not going to happen, right? And the reason it's not going to happen is because of what I said earlier. Most of these problems are people and process problems. Well, you know, we can't stop operations for the clients so that you can do people and process fixes. And people are just not going to be that open to change. I mean, there's a whole like hearts and minds campaign that has to go on. And really, I've seen those processes take years. And if there's anybody in executive management out there listening who wants to know how to shorten that time frame, it's going back to what we talked about earlier, which means you have to get involved.
I feel like it's the people at the very top that are supposed to be setting the tone.
Yeah.
Those are some of the hardest people to get to change.
Yeah.
Like, I can't tell you how many times I've had phone calls where it's managing partner or owner of this big business, right? And they're like, well, I don't want to do security awareness training. And I'm like, dude, if you're not doing it, how can we expect your employees to be doing it to make sure your money stays safe? Like, I had a big claim that they got by on the skin of their teeth on this one, where, to keep it anonymous, about a $20 million company. And one of the owners of that company was just using a Yahoo email address. So they had all of these controls, and I'd worked with them and I talked about all the various regulations and et cetera, and I talked to their MSP, right? And I had like 3-way calls, and I'm like, okay, yep, that's a really good idea for these reasons. Like, let me translate MSP into business owner and why that's important on the insurance side. And then lo and behold, right, one of the owners is using a Yahoo address, completely circumvents all of those controls. And guess what he had in his, I didn't even know you could have an email inbox this big, a ton of social security numbers, right? A ton. And I'm like, and I went back and I looked because their insurance provider was mandating MFA for email access. And I was like, I don't think Yahoo has MFA. I'm like, maybe I'm wrong. I don't think I've ever had a Yahoo email address. They literally got out of that requirement because they had renewed 3 days before that requirement came into play for that insurer. And I was like, I was sitting there going, I mean, and this was a multi-million dollar loss. So I was sitting there going, oh my God, I hope I don't get sued just because they need money. I'm like, this is crazy. I'm like, thank God they just 3 days later, they would have been screwed. And funny enough, I had some of the other owners on a conference call and they were like, yeah, I don't know if we're going to be able to get them to change out of this, you know, Yahoo email address. And I'm like, listen, you don't have an option. Like one, I will not be your insurance guy because I'm not getting sued for this. Right. I was like, and I'm putting this in writing after the phone call. I was like, and two, you're not going to have insurance. Like when they find out about this, they're going to crucify you.
Right.
And your next renewal, you're going to have to fix it.
Well, you know, you make an excellent point, and it's something that I've brought up to clients over and over and over and over and over again. And the hot question I ask them is your convenience more important than your business continuing to exist? Because this is oftentimes what it's coming down to. You know, you have to make a decision between do you care more about the business continuing to exist as a successful entity, or is your personal convenience more important? Because there's never an argument that can be made that says, oh no, I have to do all of my business through Yahoo, you know, or, you know, I have to look at porn at work, you know, or some of these ridiculous things that we hear. And I'll share an interesting little story with you. Years ago, this was when kind of HIPAA was maybe 5-6 years old. And so it wasn't like totally new, but it was still in that time frame when I think most of the docs were very, very much so in a rebellious state against it. And I would see docs who would do their medical transcription recordings. They would then take those recordings and instead of, you know, uploading them to the file server or something, because that would be easy to do, no, they were literally making their lives harder and more insecure. So they wouldn't use their work email to email the recording of the transcription to their office manager. No. They'd open up Gmail and attach the recording of their, you know, patient history notes and all of this for medical transcription. And then they would take their personal Gmail account with this attachment and then send it to their office manager's work email address. I mean, like when I'm telling you, like crazy stuff has gone on. And this is all simply because of the attitude that their convenience and I might also add, lack of willingness to be open to having a little bit of retraining. Those two things, which is all about their ego and all about their convenience, that's more important to them than the success of the business. Clearly more important than the privacy of the patient data.
Yeah, also a blatant FTC violation.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, right? And I ended up firing that client because I'm like, you know, I can't help you.
Yeah, there's actually a famous in my neck of the woods, FTC consent order dealing with medical transcriptions, where they were sending it over to India and then those guys weren't secure, right? And that thing happened and then they got a 20-year consent order slapped on them by the FTC with like every additional control under the sun. So it's like, you know, as far as controls go, I always tell people, you're going to increase your security and you got two options. You can do it the easy way or you can do it the hard way. Now, the easy way is work with your MSP, work with your IT folks. You don't have to be an expert, right? Go to them with like, hey, what's your wish list? What's the biggest bang for the buck? Explain to me like I'm five what these things do and why we need it. It's like, okay. Or cyber insurance is going to get you. The regulators are going to get you, right? Class action claims, a plaintiff bar is going to come after you. It's like, in which case, hey, just go out, look at any breach notification letter. Every single one of them says, we are enhancing our security controls to mitigate this risk from happening in the future. Why? Because you don't want to get sued for looking grossly negligent. And it's like, if you just had a plan of implementation and you go, all right, even without like qualitative, quantitative risk assessment aside, right? It's where are we? Where do we need to be? How do we get there? All right, we don't have unlimited money. IT folks, what's the biggest bang for the buck? How do you think we can implement this? All right, in 2 months, we're going to do this. In 4 months, we're going to do this. In 6 months, we're going to do this. And stick with the plan. Just stick with the plan.
So, you know, you were talking about it on the penalty side, and I think there's an even bigger carrot out there. It's you know, carrot stick, right? So the actual thing that I think moves most business owners is the acknowledgement that their customers require them to have viable policies in effect.
Yeah, I'm seeing more and more of that. I'm seeing way more contractual requirements, one, to carry cyber insurance, contractual requirements to have higher security thresholds internally at the business, right? As far as like cybersecurity controls go. You know, like I'm seeing all this stuff. And it's like, hey, don't, you know, don't shoot yourself in the foot. It's way easier to have more security than you think you need, right? To have better security than you think you need. So when you're going to these RFPs, it's like, easy, check that box. As opposed to coming to me and saying, all right, well, now I need more cyber insurance, but to do that, I got to implement this additional control, or my IT guy is saying it's going to cost me like this much money to do this thing, to try and get an RFP, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you already lost the plot. It's just, you want the security so that you don't have to worry about the security.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and there's no time. You know, if you have something like, let's say an RFP, and you know, it says, and you have to have this in place, You can't twist that knob fast enough. It's just not possible. You know, in some cases, the ones that I've been seeing lately, you know, I go back to policy and process and people, right? The things I've been seeing lately is, you know, what are you doing? What are your internal data handling practices? And seen this big misperception around, oh, our data is in this, you know, SaaS provider. You know, they're looking at like, let's say Salesforce, right? Or this is our medical record system or whatever it is, right? So they're saying our data is in this thing, so you know it's secure, and they think that that's like the end of the story. And it's like, no, look at the question. The question is, what are your data handling practices? Okay, the data has to get in there somehow. Your people access it. They do something with the data. You know, what are you doing about onboarding new employees to ensure that they know what the correct data handling practices are? Have you audited your data handling practices? Is there any sort of policy for it? Is there HR enforcement for people who are not acting in accordance with the policy? You know, it's like this, I would really love it if this myth that says I can just hire the SaaS platform and I can put my stuff there and no, we're good. No, you're not good.
No, even the FTC says you are responsible for the security of your vendors. Right. So easy. Have you requested a SOC report? Right. You don't have to know if it's type one or if it's SOC one, SOC two, SOC three, type one, type two. Like, at least start there. Right. Like, get a SOC report as just kind of like step one to say, all right, that's like the very beginning of data handling practices. And you're right. You have to start looking internally, even something as simple as like physical security. Right? Do you have a clean desk policy at the end of the day? Do you have a bunch of PII laying on a desk that the cleaning staff's going to steal? Is the cleaning staff vetted, right? Are there background checks on the cleaning staff? And to some people listening to this, they're probably like, that sounds stupid. To which I would reply, I've dealt with every single one of those claims. Like, what are your employees doing with portable electronic devices? Is there, like, what happens if they lose a work laptop. Who do they have to report it to? Is that stuff encrypted? Can you remotely wipe it? On and on and on. And it's like, why do I bring that up? Because I've dealt with every single one of those cases by this point.
Yep.
And it's like, I don't want you to make the same mistake, because I know I get to unfortunately see all the back end, right? So I'm in the wonderful position. I get to talk on the front end about, all right, here's insurance, blah, 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 but also increase your security. Here's some rules that you might want to talk to your attorney about, on and on and on. I also get to see the back end of just like the soul crushing pain of dealing with some of these cyber events that I'm like, it's like being a parent, right? Where you tell your kid, like, don't touch the stove. It's hot. And then inevitably they're like, bam, la, and they start crying and freak out. And you're like, I told you, man, like, let me help you. But I told you, like, what'd you think was going to happen?
Right.
Well,
thanks so much for your time on this. This has been great. I think it's been highly informative, and hopefully it will provoke people to engage in some heavy-duty critical thinking. And in case they need any additional topping up on their critical thinking provocations, there are other Breakfast Bites podcasts, and then there is Joe Brunsman's YouTube channel, which I would highly recommend. So thanks a lot for coming, Joe.
Hey, thanks, Felicia.